Welcome to the Pint and Click podcast. I'm Dave. I'm here with Tony and Jamie, and today we're going to talk about things that are strange. We're going to talk about books and comic books and TV shows that are strange or weird or a little offbeat, and we're also going to talk about Doctor Strange, the recent Marvel movie in theaters now. Tony's going to go first. Tony, what do you have for us today?
Yeah, I have an animated / live TV show that is kind of an improv series that is on CISO TV called Harmon Quest. Mm-hmm. And let me unpack exactly what it is, because that's a lot of things. It's a group of kind of improv comedians that sit at a table with a dungeon master, and they play D&D, and they're just kind of live acting their characters in front of a live studio audience. And then later in production, they recut everything to include their animated avatars. So it kind of makes for a kind of a hybrid style television show where they cut away from during dramatic moments where everybody is making expressions on their faces, they'll cut to the live recording. But then for a lot of the other action and when there's like attacking the monster and showing the monster and all this other kind of fictional things that are going on in the game world, they'll show you a really kind of plucky rendering of their Dungeons & Dragons characters. Mm. So it's a very interesting idea and it's very well executed. So it started off as a podcast segment, like at the end of Dan Harmon's regular podcast, Harmontown. I guess it started as just like a segment that was so popular that when they pitched the idea, this comedy network, CISO TV, decided to sign it up for a 10-episode series. And now I guess it's going into its second season because it has gotten pretty popular and it's pretty... I'm really into it. I haven't even watched the whole thing because I'm watching it with my wife and I want to make sure we kind of keep current on it. But let me tell you a little bit about how the story goes, I guess, because you're probably wondering, how do they make this interesting enough to not just be watching people play D&D, because sure, that can actually be kind of boring. It is very heavily dependent on the Dungeon Master, who is Spencer Crittenden, and he makes a story that is compelling enough to keep everyone interesting, but not boggled down by the details to make it slow going. Mm-hmm. So in any one given episode, they'll have a guest star who is introduced and then promptly... usually something, as events escalate, maybe they'll end up in conflict with the party or something. And then so the other actors will for some reason be in conflict with them, and that, or maybe they'll side and betray them, side with the bad guy or side with the monsters. And usually they'll die or somehow otherwise getting written off the thing. And it all happens in a half hour long episode. So it's really quite a feat of storytelling. The characters obviously are kind of funny spoofs on the archetypes that you're used to. So there's like Aaron McGathy plays like this barbarian who like goes into barbarian rages, and like there's a goblin thief that runs around and tries to do sneak attacks. And then when they like fail a roll or something doesn't pan out for that character, because again, there's randomized game system where everybody's, you know, it tends to be even funnier when things don't work out. Mm-hmm. It's a really easy to watch show that for people that are into Dungeons & Dragons, but then at the same time, if you're curious on what D&D is, it's also a really good introduction because they don't really spend that much time on the rules. And it's more like, oh, this is what it could be. This is kind of the fun part. It's the interacting of four people sitting around a table where the Dungeon Master is kind of, albeit in these scenarios, very much driving the plot into one kind of direction. But yeah, I think it's a lot of fun. And there's some really good guest stars. Aubrey Plaza from
Parks and Rec.
Parks and Rec, mm-hmm. Thank you. And Thomas Middleditch from Silicon Valley. There's cool. Many people that you've seen in other places that do come on the show. So
is the whole plot of the story the plot of the game that's happening, or are there, you know, do they talk about other things that are happening in their lives beyond their characters in the game?
No, I think if, like, Dan Harmon is kind of funny in that he's, like, kind of a self-deprecating type of humor. Like, he's the writer behind Community and Rick and Morty, but, like, when his character in a previous episode, when he was, like, very cowardly and didn't stand up for himself, I mean, they talk about the, jokingly, but yet it is the content of the show. He talks about how, like, oh, I was so cowardly in that last encounter. My character is going to deeply ponder his insecurities and all of this and then try to do something heroic. So they kind of build that narrative in. But if it's done, it's done because the actors and these improv artists want to make something out of it. Mm-hmm. So they'll often play with each other, play off of what the other person is doing, or they won't. It'll just fall dead and you'll see it fall dead. And it's kind of funny if it goes in that direction. So oftentimes the guest stars will bring something seemingly out of the blue, like, oh, I have to go upstairs and get my bomb kit, you know, and then, oh, there's going to be explosives. And who would have thought, you know, this is all tied into one cohesive storyline somehow, but it seems like they're making it up on the spot. It's really hard for me to tell as a spectator, like what was placed there by the Dungeon Master for the guest star and what was just totally like improv.
Sure.
Because they make it tie together pretty nicely and they animate it. So
It sounds interesting to me because a lot of D&D and a lot of role-playing games is improvisation. Mm-hmm. So having actors who improv as a profession sit in on a D&D game, either as guests or as regulars, sounds fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. They're going to be naturally inclined to this environment. I would love to see actors that can improv but don't play D&D, mm-hmm. how they fare their first time playing this game. That would be amazing to watch.
It's definitely not disappointing. It's just like the archetypes they use in the game are like so easy to catch on to. And the weird twists that they do on traveling salesman, like he just happened to have an entire wagon full of like sandwiches. They were and the party was starving in the middle of the desert. So it's like, oh, that's just so convenient, you know. But it's great that their storyteller guy, the Spencer Crittenden, the DM, he's able to just roll with it and acknowledge that it's going to be hilarious and silly and not fight the tendencies of these comedians to make really great content, really hilarious content, and kind of make a wacky, kind of zany world. So
so that's cool. So that's Harmon Quest. That's on CISO?
Yes, CISO TV, which is a subscription online. You can do a free trial for 30 days if you sign up with your email.
And you can watch it on a web browser or probably like on your Roku or Chromecast, something like that. All right, very cool. All right, Jamie, you're up next. What would you like to talk about today?
I'm talking about the book As She Climbed Across the Table by Jonathan Lethem. I've been calling him Lethem for the past decade, and then I listened to a podcast that he was on, New York Times podcast, I think, and then he said his name is Lethem, and I was like, I guess I was wrong. But with the theme of strange, this is one of my favorite books and also one of the strangest books I've ever read. Lethem's known for his genre-bending work. Sometimes it's a little surreal, it's a little sci-fi-y, but it's also very much in like the literary fiction tradition. And this one is very similar in that As She Climbed Across the Table is, in some ways, a small story in that it's about the relationship between the narrator, whose name is Philip, and he's a professor who studies professors. So he studies like the work life and professorship and things like that. And his partner, Alice, who he lives with, who is a particle physicist. So that's on one level is the story of the relationship. So it's rather domestic. But on another level, it's about the universe. So Alice is a particle physicist. And what she and her team are just trying to do is kind of connect to this universe that they sense is out there. So here's where like the science fiction part is. So that seems kind of out there. But instead, what they connect to is what they call a singularity. And what they gradually realize is a nothingness, an absence, what she calls the lack. And so it's like the size of a table, and it is the absence of anything, the absence of like particles or atoms or anything. So she's obsessed with studying this and grows to realize that you can throw things through it and the lack will eat some things. It'll take it away to wherever, and some things it won't. So she begins to spend all her time testing the lack and spending all her time with it. And we see this from the perspective of Philip, her partner, who gradually is realizing that his partner is growing farther and farther away from him and kind of has the existential question of how do I get my lover back when she's in love with literally nothing? It's not an adversary I can take down. It's not another man. It's not another professor. It's nothingness. And because of that, it is infinitely enticing, I guess. And there's a lot more of this, which is kind of more into quantum mechanics, but not in a way that I can't really coherently explain, in a way that will actually do justice to it, but in a way that isn't going to be, it won't put you off if you're not into that at all. I don't know anything about quantum mechanics, and it wasn't too difficult for me because it really is based into the relationship between these two people and how a relationship can falter and the steps you try to go through to get someone to love you again against this weird and zany backdrop. At one point, these two men come and live at their home with them, and both of them are blind, and they're just really zany in the way that they talk to each other is really weird, and then they disappear, and no one knows where they went. The fear in Philip's head the whole time is, what if she chooses the lack over me? What if she goes inside? Sure. What will happen? Will the lack love her back and thus eat her and take her away to wherever these things are going or not? So it's interesting because it's science fiction, but where you get it from the perspective of someone who's not part of that science fiction. It's more of like what a reader would see. You're not part of that world. Philip is not part of that science fictional world that Alice is part of. So he's kind of detached from it. So we kind of have this dual literature where one is firmly grounded in literary fiction and the mm-hmm. other is more in the science fiction realm. And I think mm-hmm. he merges them really well.
Hmm. How would you say it's like his other work? This looks very short. Mm-hmm. Is it accessible?
I would say it's more accessible than his other works. If you're looking at things like Fortress of Solitude, I haven't finished his newest one, which is Gambler's Anatomy yet. Mm. But the shortness does compress the story a little bit. There's less characters. A lot of his other works are, you know, really sprawling. There's 50 different characters who all have very bizarre names.
Right.
And you're trying to keep track of what's happening, and there's like 30 different subplots. Mm. This one, the plot is much more straightforward, but it is more metaphysical and discussing what love is, like what existence is, and things like that. But I would say it is less difficult to keep track of, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Is the dual narrative that you're kind of talking about, the two stories, one of them is more from the perspective of one of the people in the relationships, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that it switches back and forth, but it's just that the world they inhabit or the perspective is so different. Philip, the narrator, because he studies professors, his work is really pedantic. It's really, you know, a lot of papers, a lot of going to classes and watching things. And she's kind of involved or envisioned in this world that's separate from our world that you don't know anything about. So they're just perspectives on the world that are very different. While Philip tries to keep this relationship together, it's like, how do these perspectives come together? Mm-hmm. How can she be satisfied with a person, a human, in this earth when she has potentially a whole other universe out there?
Mm-hmm. So interesting. I'm just curious too, does it favor one over the other? Is it more tension building, you know, in one case or the other? Or is it kind of stay uniform, or does it?
I mean, I don't think it's the tension is definitely not, in terms of like plot tension, that's not one of the core, I think, goals of the book. The ending is very open-ended, which some people find frustrating, I think. And it becomes, at the end, it becomes very weird because different universes become accessed by multiple characters, and then things tilt a lot. It's kind of making me think of that movie we saw, R100, where you think it's one thing at the beginning, and then towards the end, it completely shifts in whatever genre you're in. You're like, oh, this is something new.
Sure.
So it does kind of switch on you in the last third.
So that's As She Climbed Across the Table by Jonathan Lethem. It looks like we have it here at the library. It looks like we got the sticker on the spine there. So you can come check that out. Do you know, is it recent? Is it older?
1997. So it's one of his older ones. So it's been around for a while.
All right. So it should be easy to find.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll go next. I am reading, again, The Manhattan Projects, which is a comic series by Jonathan Hickman. I reread the first volume to kind of prepare for this podcast. And what it is the story of an alternate history, America. The Manhattan Project that we all know is the project to build the atomic bomb, and it brought together a lot of great scientists. In this series, The Manhattan Projects, that is a cover story for much weirder and bizarre science happening. A lot of occult stuff, a lot of science fiction stuff. And the scientists that are working on the project are not mere mortals. They all have some sort of terrible secret or specific quality about them that is unique. Like Oppenheimer has multiple personalities. Einstein is from another dimension. Fermi is actually an alien, which is kind of the best subtle joke I've ever read in my life. And so it's the story of, if you love weird science, if you love Japan attacks their bureaucracy with sentient origami that they send in reams of paper unknown until it folds up in the office and starts killing people. If you love weird science like that, if you love Jonathan Hickman writes huge stories where the galaxy is at peril and only this one group of ragtag scientists can save it or destroy it or navigate it or whatever they must do. And so it's always the universe or the galaxy hangs in the balance with what little things that we do here on Earth. One thing that I think it's kind of striking about it is that the art is very grimy. He loves lines on faces. He loves little hairs. He loves stubble. It kind of turns me off on some characters because it makes them absolutely just ugly, and I hate looking at them. The general or admiral who heads up the Manhattan Projects is just an ugly-looking, balding, fat guy, and the art really sends that home. And then it things like everyone looks worried, everyone looks tired, which is probably true of the people working on the Manhattan Project. They probably did feel that way. They probably did look that way. I have such enthusiasm. I've read it before, and I'm reading it again. I was almost excited when I tried to think of something strange for the podcast. I was like, oh boy, I can read the Manhattan Projects again. It has ended. There was a run of 5 volumes of trades. So that's, whatever, roughly 35 issues, 32 issues. I'm not sure which it is. And then they started a 6th one, and that one just kind of hangs out there. I don't know if they're going to do more or not. But it's fascinating, it's funny, and it's definitely weird.
When did these come out?
Just a couple years ago. I think this is like 2013 for Manhattan Projects Volume 1. It probably was 2013 to 2015 for the 5 volumes to come out. So very recent. I think Hickman just finished his run on Fantastic Four when he started this. These are from Image Comics. If you are into publications, Image makes some really weird stuff right now. They publish Saga, they publish East of West, in addition to the Manhattan Projects. So if you're looking for weird, Image is the way to go. I think it's definitely weirder than DC and Marvel right now.
Yeah.
Are the enemies that they face also based in real people of that time, or
a little bit? Not always. Mm-hmm. They are at war with Germany and Japan. It mm-hmm. is World War II, but there are space aliens in play. It might be kind of a spoiler, but Oppenheimer and Einstein run a little dark in this book. Like, they are not shining paragons of virtue and justice. Mm-hmm. They have an agenda, and you don't mm-hmm. quite know what it is mm-hmm. for nearly all of the book. And they're violent here and there. They hold it back, but when they let loose, they let loose. And it's a little scary to see these quiet, serious men just turn to violence when you flip a page and you were not expecting it. That's not a big spoiler. These happen in the first book, so it's not. I'm not giving away the major twists that happened towards the end. But it is. It's probably the weirdest thing I've read. East of West is close. But this is definitely, it's weirder because it's a spin on these characters. It's a spin on Einstein and Oppenheimer sure. and Fermi and Feynman. I can't recommend it enough. If you're looking for a comic book that's not superheroes, I recommend it to almost anyone that comes in the building. I recommended it to our maintenance manager when he was looking for something for his 21-year-old son. I'm like, let me give you Manhattan Projects. It's amazing. Yeah. Alongside Saga. It's definitely readable if you can tolerate the art. Like I say, it's not bad, but it's just grimy and a little off-putting, and that's on purpose. Mm-hmm. I get that, but still, it's hard to look at people's faces sometimes when you read this book.
Do you know if it's on Hoopla, on our digital platform? Because I know we have some other Image ones, so we might have that one.
I'm not sure. Okay. I know if you sign up to Comixology Unlimited, mm-hmm. the first several issues are free, okay. not the entire series, so you can kind of get into it that way. Mm-hmm. We do have all 6 books on the shelf today. Okay. I did see them before coming in to do the podcast, so they are available at Des Plaines Public Library. So then let's move into our group discussion about things that are strange, and it is Doctor Strange. I checked before coming in to the podcast. This is the 14th movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, wow. if you go all the way back to Iron Man 1. Mm-hmm. This is the 7th origin story of a character, like Iron Man 1, Incredible Hulk 1, mm-hmm. Thor 1. This is the 7th mm-hmm. movie in that vein. And what did we think of Doctor Strange?
I liked it all right. I mean, it was go in with no expectations and still be satisfied, I guess, mm-hmm. even though it was a straightforward story. I think there was enough, like, well, the word is weird, I think, today, weird lore. And mm-hmm. and it was compelling enough and funny enough and charming enough the whole way through. And the characters were maybe few, but they had an awesome screen presence. So there was no complaints there. And mm-hmm. the action was, I think maybe it had a little bit much on the action side, but I guess I can't complain too much about that. I think they did a really good job on this one.
For me, what I liked about this was one of the things that I didn't like as much in other films in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because usually when it gets to a fight scene, I'm like, ugh, I'm bored. You know, in their TV shows, we've seen some great fight scenes, you know, and Luke Cage and things like that. But in these movies, I'm always like, well, we're in an airplane hangar this time, you know, somewhere where something else would sell. Someone's throwing something. And but here, obviously, the you would make an analogy to Inception. But the visuals blew my mind. And I was so enthralled with it to see people running on these buildings that are just becoming perpendicular and sliding into one another. So that's what really caught my attention. And then the story, which I'm usually more like into, I was like, meh. But
yeah, it's kind of another one of those movies, another origin story. It's another hero's journey. It's another, you know, I'm a fish out of water and I need to learn these new skills. And then I'm put to the test kind of all over again, which is unfortunate. I think one of the big saves, though, that make this movie pretty good, I enjoyed it a lot, even despite this boilerplate plot, was the acting of Benedict Cumberbatch and Tilda Swinton and even Rachel McAdams, as small as her part was, really made it feel a lot more human than the other superhero movies, which are kind of playing an archetype. They're almost playing a parody, I think. Tony Stark is over the top, but I don't think Doctor Strange was over the top. The visual, certainly, but the actual character, the voicing, the acting, the body language, the presentation, I think that was all pretty good. I'm very hopeful for Doctor Strange in the future. How he plays into the other Marvel movies might be interesting, because I'm excited to see more of this character.
I agree. I think the little things I enjoyed, like you were saying, are like bits of humor that maybe in another movie would be pushed to the hilt if it was in, you know, say, Guardians of the Galaxy. Because obviously it's not a comedy in the way that that was, but there were humorous instances, like when Doctor Strange is putting on that cape and then it keeps trying to like push his face and he's trying to avoid it. So there's moments like that that wouldn't be in, say, you know, Batman Begins, if we're looking at another like origin story, that kept it more light. And just Benedict Cumberbatch and his American accent, you know. I think the difficulty for me in terms of the story was I felt like there was so much time given to, like, his building up scene, going to, I guess, Tibet, you know, and meeting the Ancient One and things like that. The pacing was slower. And then we get to Dormammu's introduced and that all of the ending part happens, where I felt like the lead up was a big part of the movie, where I thought that maybe this movie will be like a Batman Begins, and then, you know, the big nemesis won't be brought in until the next movie. Because I was like, how can there be time for this to be brought together? I thought, you know, we didn't have that much time left. And we didn't have that much time left, but they still brought Dormammu in. And I guess if you know the comics, then it might not be as big of a deal for you. But since I never read any of Doctor Strange or anything, I was really confused about who this other being was and what was going on. And I just felt like a lot was thrown at me at the end. And it just mattered less because I didn't understand why this person was so evil or why it was so bad that Tilda Swinton had been sucking out his energy the whole time. Or
They kind of just, they made that really superficial. They call it the dark universe or the dark dimension. And they're like, oh, she's drawing power from the dark dimension. You're like, oh, I assume that is bad because it's the dark dimension. So they kind of tied that up with a real fast little, this guy is bad. You can tell because his eyes are blacked out. Let's go. And that, there was not a lot of backstory to the evil forces, which I think was okay because it might have slowed the movie down if they had told those stories. But on the other hand, you're just supposed, you just got to suspend your disbelief and run along with the movie. All right, whatever you say, movie, if you say this is bad, I'll accept that it's bad. So it's a little superficial in that vein, I think, where I don't even remember the villain's name, the guy who steals the pages out of the book. I don't, who knows? You just know that he's bad. Dormammu, we only remember his name because they say it over and over and over again. Which maybe that's an effective technique. Yeah, the visuals were stunning. There's no doubt about that. There's a lot of the city folding in on itself. We've seen that in the commercials. But there's also, like, Tilda Swinton kind of sends him for a ride through these great spacescapes, I don't know what you'd call them, of planets hanging in the balance and geometric figures folding in and out of each other as he flies through space screaming. All that was fascinating.
It was very good because it persisted for such a long period of time that you, as a viewer, you were kind of starting to get us disoriented because you're not used to seeing weird flashing images on your screen like that. And
I wonder what it would have been like to see it in 3D, because I bet that would be one where it would be worth it to see.
I saw it in 3D.
Oh,
I wasn't blown away.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I saw it in IMAX 3D. Mm-hmm. I always go for IMAX. I don't always go for 3D. I did see it in 3D, and it did not blow my socks off. It was good, but it was not as good as the 3D in The Hobbit, which I liked very much, the 3D in The Hobbit, because it was very subtle and very effective, whereas this kind of seemed like a 3D comic book where it's just jumping right at your face, and you're like, yeah, well, all right, I don't need the – it doesn't have to be this extraordinary, this extreme.
Mm-hmm. One thing I was interested in seeing was how they would treat the character of the Ancient One, since there was a lot of criticism for casting Tilda Swinton in it, since it's another whitewashing of another character that was originally Asian and casting a white character. I remember Tilda Swinton saying in interviews before that, oh, in the movie, it's not supposed to be an Asian character. She's not playing an Asian character. But still, when you see her out there, you know, with her shaved head in this clearly in Asia, all the other extras around her are Asian, and then she's throwing her fans around and stuff. I was like,
yeah, it's strange and complicated. I don't know what to say to that. I mean, if you want to get down to some of the details, Doctor Strange was originally Asian, and then they changed it in the comic books very early on in the 60s. Mordo was white, but now he's black in this movie. There were a lot of changes made. I don't know if one change is better or worse than any other. But it's certainly something that people need to pay more attention to, because there was a very strong reaction to the Tilda Swinton casting, which I loved because I love her as an actress. But then when I heard this response, I realized, yeah, there's something to this. People come to expect these characters to be portrayed faithfully. And I don't know if she was in this movie.
I think it would be different if this is a one-time situation or if there are characters for Asian actors and actresses, but there aren't. They're just not portrayed. So I think when there is one opportunity for, you know, an Asian American actor or actress, and then that's taken away, I think that's why there's so much backlash. If there were a lot of other opportunities, I don't think it would have been.
And contrasted with the fact that Marvel Comics is doing a phenomenal job right now shaking things up. Thor is a woman. The Incredible Hulk is Asian. They're throwing out the old characters and coming up with new ones because that is, you know, the way the world is, and they want to reflect that. So Marvel Comics is doing this great job, whereas the Marvel movies, maybe not so much. That's causing some dissonance in the community where you don't know, well, which one should I support? Can I support both at the same time?
Why do you think that the comics are more willing to take a more innovative vein? Because obviously for the movies, they want bigger name actors and actresses to get people to come to it. Is the financial part of it in comics not as big of a deal?
So one thing I know is that it's been effective. Ms. Marvel has been a phenomenally, Captain Marvel and the new Thor have been very successful. So Marvel's learning that these are characters that readers want to read. These are characters that people want to buy these books. And I don't think the movie industry has gotten there yet. Whereas the comic books, it's like they gave it a try. They made Captain Marvel a woman. Let's see how it does. And it does great. It's like, let's make Thor a woman. And it does great. So they're like, this is wonderful. We should have all sorts of diverse characters. We can retire Bruce Banner. Like, what's the big deal? And there's already four or five Hulks. What's a new Hulk?
Yeah, I wish that the movies would try it on one at least, because I think there would be a lot of support for that.
I think there's a problem with these movies where it's like the movies are the legitimate version of a comic book character. And I think it's time to let go of that. It's time to experiment with the movie versions of comic book characters and not try to hammer it down to the one perfect archetype that everyone has in their minds, and just let go and have something strange and have something different in the movies. Suicide Squad did that a little bit. Deadpool did that a little bit, where it's like, let's try something that's out of character and see how it does, and it's doing well. So,
which movie do you think was the most straying from what people would think of as the archetype of that character?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. Guardians of the Galaxy is actually like the least, I would say, because Rocket Raccoon and Groot were so accurately portrayed that I think that one stands apart because it's the last thing you expect from a movie is to have a character who can only say his name. And how do you film that? How do you write a script around that? And they found a way to do it. So Deadpool is a lot of different things under a lot of different writers. And I think the movie Deadpool was kind of just Ryan Reynolds' version of that character, sure. as opposed to Daniel Way's version of that character or Rick Remender's version of that character, how they write them in the books. So I think Deadpool was a great character. They took some ideas, but they didn't take some characteristics and applied it to the movie version. So I think Deadpool maybe has the widest distance between the movie character and the comic book character while still being funny, mm-hmm. breaks the fourth wall, and violent. Like, they kept those three things, but the way they're expressed is very different. Mm-hmm. In X-Force, the Rick Remender Deadpool is, you know, kind of noble, kind of hopeful, kind of really trying to do his best, but succumbs to his baser abilities and instincts when it comes to conflict. And he regrets it and expresses that, which is nothing like the movie Deadpool. So do you recommend Doctor Strange? What do you think? Pretty good, not bad. I think that's where we're on the yeah. scale, that's about where we're falling.
Pretty good.
I think it was entertaining. Yeah. And, you know, most people, when they want to see a movie, it's entertaining, and it was visually stunning.
Yeah.
So I think paying the $12 or whatever to see a movie theater to see those visuals would be worth it.
Yeah, I recommend it. It's not the best movie of the year, I don't know, but it's definitely really cool. And I had a lot of fun for 2 hours, so you can't beat that. You can't ask for much more from a movie.
Mm-hmm. I agree too.
All right. Okay, well, that's the Pint and Click podcast. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.